The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payden for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Religion News Service. Our first article was published on the 24th of February and written by Yonat Shimron, entitled, A U.S. Rabbi Bears Witness to the Trauma in Ukraine 1 year after Russian invasion. 1 year ago, Russia invaded Ukraine and started a war that has wreaked untold damage. Tens of thousands of deaths, cities flattened, and more than 8 million refugees, many of whom fled to neighboring European countries. Religious groups have responded generously. Samaritan's Purse, to cite one prominent Christian relief organization, has made 42 airlifts of food, water, and medicine to the war-ravaged country since the start of the war on February 24, 2022. But Ukraine is a diverse country religiously, and Americans of different faiths have offered prayers and provisions. Before World War II, Jews comprised some 26% of the population of Kyiv, the capital. Famously, its president, Volodymyr Zelensky, is Jewish. American Jews, many of whom are descendants of the Jews of Ukraine, have not forgotten, sending supplies, money, and emotional support. Earlier this month, Rabbi Charles Feinberg joined an interfaith delegation that traveled to Kyiv and its surroundings to learn more about religious communities, bear witness to the unfolding loss of life and limb, and show solidarity with the Ukrainian people. His mission, organized by a Polish group called Europe, a Patient, included a British imam, a British rabbi, and two Polish Catholic priests. The group of seven stayed at a Dominican monastery in Kyiv during their five-day tour, February 7th to 11th. Arinus spoke to Feinberg, now 76, and retired from Addis Israel, a prominent Washington, D.C. conservative synagogue. The following interview was edited for length and clarity. RNS, why did you decide to take this trip? It sounded like an important opportunity. The Ukrainians extended an invitation, and I felt honored by it. I arrived Tuesday morning and left Saturday evening. You can't fly into Kyiv. The airport is closed. I flew to Warsaw, Poland, and then took a series of train trips from Warsaw to Krakow, and then from Krakow to Przemyśl, and then an overnight from Przemyśl to Kyiv. Isn't it dangerous to travel to Ukraine? There was an element of danger to this, but the people of Kyiv go about their normal business. There were two air raid sirens when we were there. We went into a shelter for 2 or 3 hours. We found out later that the Ukrainian Air Force had shot down 10 drones over Kyiv. We didn't hear anything. I read that since the start of the war, there have been 600 air raid alerts in Kyiv alone. Another town, south of Kyiv, was hammered really hard with about 17 missiles while we were there. So you never know where there might be a missile or drone attack. We were told there would be rolling blackouts, but we didn't experience that. There was a curfew from 11 p.m. to 6 a.m., so we had to hustle to get back to the monastery before the curfew. Does Kyiv look destroyed? Not at all. It's a beautiful city on the Dnieper River. We went to some of the towns in the 60 kilometers around Kyiv, Bucha, Irpin, and Borodyanka, where the war was battled fiercely and saw a lot of destroyed buildings and evidence of human rights abuses and atrocities. What was the mood of the Ukrainians? They've gone through incredible trauma. We heard from people who lost family members. We heard from a woman in Borodyanka whose building was hit by a missile. She got out, but her daughter and son-in-law died. Everyone there has gone through some sort of trauma. There are centers for displaced persons in Kyiv. We visited one with lots of families and children. We heard personal testimonies of people who fought against the Russians and have suffered because of it. We heard from a woman who is a psychologist who worked with developmentally disabled children. But all those children were evacuated from Ukraine and placed in different European countries. So she lost her job. Then she started working with families who experienced trauma in the war. She said after a while, it drove her crazy. She herself experienced trauma personally. Her son-in-law was killed. Many Ukrainians have relatives in Russia. We came across a woman in Irpin who said that many buildings were destroyed. She had shot a video of what was happening and sent it to her relatives in Russia. They refused to believe it. They said the soldiers were actors dressed up as Russian soldiers. The anger at Russia is quite high, to say the least. What are the displaced persons centers like? In Kyiv, one of them is a four-story building. They made playrooms for children and dormitory-like rooms for families. Bordayanka had 29 apartment buildings before the war, and 20 of them were destroyed. We saw temporary housing put up. We saw a school that was gutted. What kind of support can religious groups in the U.S. provide? Ukraine is diverse religiously. There's a significant Muslim population that lives in the east, and the Donbas and Crimea. The Russians persecuted Muslims there. They closed some of the mosque. There are at least three or four branches of Orthodox Christianity, and they make up the largest Christian group. One branch of the Orthodox Church is affiliated with the Orthodox Patriarch in Constantinople. Another branch is affiliated with the Orthodox Patriarch in Moscow. A third branch is an independent Ukrainian Orthodox Church. We heard at length about the need for medical supplies of all kinds, from bandages to ambulances. A lot of soldiers lost limbs, so there's a need for prosthetic devices. We learned that the Russians don't pick up their fallen soldiers from the battlefield. The bodies decay and decompose, and the groundwater becomes poisoned. In some areas, there's a shortage of fresh water. So Ukrainian relief is really important, both to the needs of the war and to start rebuilding. Are you afraid the world's attention is receding or shifting elsewhere? Yes, that's a concern as the war grinds on. But the Ukrainians aren't tired of it. They will keep fighting until they get all their land back. There's a very strong consensus about that. It's unlikely they'll get all their land back, though, isn't it? They don't think so. They speak very confidently about it. Now an article from the Religion News Service that was published on the 21st of February, written by Emily McFarlane Miller, entitled, Loyola's Sister Jean Captured Hearts During March Madness. Now she's written a book. Chicago. Sister Jean Dolores Schmidt entered religious life at 18 to become a school teacher, and though Bob Hope's kids and a future cardinal were among her students over the years, when fame came, international fame, she'd remind you, it was as chaplain to the Loyola University Ramblers during the men's basketball team's improbable 2018 run to the NCAA Final Four. Now 103, Chicago's beloved Catholic sister, best known as Sister Jean, has added publishing a memoir to her list of achievements. Wake Up with Purpose, What I've Learned in My First 100 Years, not only chronicles Sister Jean's long life. Growing up in California, she remembers watching the Golden Gate Bridge being built and playing intramural basketball when the sport was still quite young, but also the wisdom she has accumulated along the way. Among the proverbs she shares, always with a sense of humor, having a consistent daily purpose not only keeps her alive, but also young and vibrant. Teamwork is what life is all about. And there's nothing like hugging a sweaty basketball player after a big win. The sister doesn't shy from controversial topics either, though she writes that she realizes to many people she sounds hopelessly old-fashioned. She voted for Hillary Clinton, but thinks too many people argued Clinton should be president because she was a woman. She believes abortion is immoral, but thinks it should be left out of politics. As a long-time educator, she doesn't understand why anybody would want to whitewash history. If we don't learn about our mistakes, how will we learn from them, she writes matter-of-factly. Sister Jean said she hopes readers will feel like she's sitting beside them, sharing stories, just as she does with students in her office at Loyola. I would just like them to feel at peace when they're reading it, she said. She spoke with RNS about what keeps her young and what it was like to become an overnight sensation after 98 years. This interview has been edited for length and clarity. RNS, you write, that's how it works with God. If you keep your faith, you never have to grow old. What is it about faith that you believe keeps you young? I think with faith comes hope and love. To me, they just can't be separated. Because if you believe in God, you certainly have hope in what He's going to do for you. And also, you love Him. My mom and dad, especially my mom, taught me early in life to love God. Dad and I love you, but God loves you even more, and so you have to love God. I believe that when you have love for other people, you have a good heart, and you're happy. And I think happiness has a lot to do with longevity, in addition to DNA, of course. That lesson your parents taught you about loving and accepting other people is a theme that runs throughout your book. Why is that acceptance and inclusivity important? Do you feel like that's something the church needs more of? Oh, I feel it's really important because God says, you know, love your neighbor as yourself. So if they're not loving other people, I don't know what people are doing about themselves because that, again, is so closely connected. We get all kinds of messages from Pope Francis that we need to do this. And he's constantly now reminding us to remember the people in Turkey and Syria. He never separates the two. And the two are certainly very different from each other. I feel now, as I experience all the disruption we have with cultures and people turning against and killing people of different cultures, I feel that my mom and dad and other moms and dads were way ahead of their time in the 30s and 40s. We just took people for granted. You were an educator for many years, and you write about how you don't understand why people today wouldn't want to teach children the unpleasant realities of our past. Why is that so important? Well, I think they need to know the truth. Sometimes people in this current age begin to talk about things as though this is a new thought that they've brought forth in the world. I'd like them to know we've been thinking about this for a long time. Generations before them have talked about this, and generations have been working toward unity and acceptance of various cultures. Sometimes they think that that hasn't happened before. You became an international celebrity as chaplain to the Loyola men's basketball team during March Madness in 2018. What was that like? I was never an international celebrity before, just Sister Jean, chaplain of the men's basketball team. After we won the first game with that beautiful shot that Dante Ingram made, we knew we were on our way. I woke up the next morning and I thought to myself, this isn't a dream. It's for real, so get going. So I began talking to reporters and so forth, and it was a lot of fun because what we were all facing was something different. We were a Cinderella team, and we still kept our shoes on, and we played as well as we could, and then we got to the Final Four. That was such a wonderful experience, and we had support all the way through that. We were the underdogs all the way. People kept cheering for us. Why do you think, in the midst of that run, you got so much attention? I think, first of all, because I'm old. Secondly, because I'm a sister. And I don't think there are too many sisters that are chaplains to men's basketball teams. And also, I think I'm a happy person. People say, Sister Jean, you bring a lot of happiness to people when the world is in such turmoil. Most of the time, we're in turmoil. or we hear about such tragic things on the news every night. But we need something to boost our happiness and our love for people. How do the Ramblers look this year? Well, we've moved into the Atlantic 10 Conference. We hadn't played very many of those schools before, so we have to learn how they play and what they do. It's been a tough year for us, but we've been doing our best. We knew from the beginning that it would take us a while to get used to the new conference. That happened to us when we moved from the Horizon League to Missouri Valley. It took us 2 years then to feel comfortable, if you want to put it that way. But they're working hard and they play well together, so we'll get there. Now, an opinion piece published in the Religion News Service on the 22nd of February, written by Murali Balaji, a journalist and lecturer at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, whose books include Digital Hinduism, How John and Alice Coltrane's Music Inspired a Vision for American Hinduism. More than 50 years after his death, John Coltrane is rightfully recognized as a giant in American music, a visionary who innovated jazz and made an indelible impact on subsequent generations of musicians in a wide variety of genres. Alice Coltrane's impact as a jazz musician might not have been as legendary as her husband's, but she emerged as a multi-genre force over her 40-year music career before her death in 2007. For all the accolades and tributes the pair have received in making their mark in music and popular culture, and becoming outsized in their role as Black history makers, the Coltranes had an arguably equal impact in reimagining American Hinduism. John Coltrane's appreciation for Hinduism grew as a result of his exposure to Hindu philosophy, which was made popular in the early to mid-1960s as a result of Indian gurus gaining attention within American counterculture circles. Coltrane also experimented with LSD, and some of his contemporaries noted that his drug use and subsequent recordings were an attempt to connect with the Supreme Being. In Coltrane's posthumously released Om, he incorporated verses from the Bhagavad Gita, while also offering his music as oblations to Brahman, the all-pervading reality in Hinduism symbolized by Om. By doing so, he presented an alternative introduction to Hindu philosophy that had, up until that point, been depicted in mainstream America as caricatured or exotic. Coltrane's homage to Hinduism was seen as a form of bhakti, or devotion, but he did not identify as Hindu, noting that he was a follower of all religions. The same could not be said of Alice Coltrane, who embraced Hinduism and became the head of an ashram in California. In the years that followed, she composed Hindu devotional music, drawing followers of different backgrounds. More importantly, she became one of the most prominent female Hindu spiritual leaders in the United States, at a time when many of the famous gurus were Indian men. While her ashram was destroyed in 2018 during the Wolseley fire, her impact on American Hinduism remains immortalized through her music, notably albums Turiya Sings, Divine Songs, and Infinite Chants. The Coltrane's son, Ravi, himself a famous jazz musician, has continued on their path of connecting spirituality with music. Both John and Alice Coltrane started their journeys as learners of Hinduism, but in their own ways, they became two of the religion's most impactful and unique gurus in its evolution into an American way of life. The last article from the Religion News Service was published on the 6th of February and written by Elizabeth E. Evans, entitled, As Pennsylvania's Bible Belt Evolves, Clergy Look to One Another for Mutual Support. Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Many outsiders who travel to Lancaster County every year are drawn by the area's reputation as the heart of Amish country. In fact, the rolling hills of the county west of Philadelphia and Lancaster City itself host a diversity of Christian faiths, with Mennonites and Anabaptists outnumbered by Catholics and mainline Protestants. Such is the area's historic religiosity that some call Lancaster County the heart of Pennsylvania's Bible Belt. But in recent years, an influx of transplants, particularly to Lancaster City and its suburbs, have made the area less religiously observant and more politically diverse. As the new residents have moved in over the past decade, clergy who've operated in a relatively homogeneous small-town culture are navigating a landscape with new tension. That friction has only been exacerbated by the difficulties of the pandemic and the widening gap between people of different political persuasions. Amid this strife, the clergy of the Warwick Ministerium, an informal action and mutual support group for the Lancaster area's pastors and other ordained Christian leaders, has been a source of calm and unity. "Iron sharpens iron," said Missy Dabler, a chaplain at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center in Lititz, a small town north of Lancaster and ministerium member, using an expression from the Book of Proverbs. "You can be isolated in a church and a particular tradition, but when you hear how others are handling it, prayerfully talking and respecting each other, the Spirit really moves through the group." Clergy of different denominations and even different faiths have long gathered to share their challenges and create community among the flocks. The Warwick Ministerium, named for the township that comprises Lititz and several other small towns around Lancaster, is no different. Dabler said the ministerium's 25 or so members have fostered some really strong friendships, amazing support, and wise counsel. It's just a group that really cares for each other. The ministerium has managed to find common ground by developing new strategies to meet the challenges of a changing religious landscape, said the Reverend Jerry McGrath, pastor at Lititz United Methodist Church and president of the ministerium. He offered the example of last November's ecumenical Thanksgiving service, which had long been hosted at one or another of the ministerium members' churches. The ministerium decided to move the 2022 service to nearby Lititz. It drew more participants than it ever had before. "Precisely," said McGrath, "because it wasn't held in a church." He congratulated the members of the ministerium for taking a countercultural approach. "Christ has always called us to lead, not control the future. What's happening in our ministerium is exploration," said McGrath. But the recent culture clashes in the community have drawn the ministerium's members into more controversial terrain. Last year, some local clergy supported a group of parents and area residents protesting books and curricula used by the Warwick School District, particularly those promoting discussion of social justice and gender identity. The Reverend Ken Miller, a retired seminary professor who has served for nearly a decade as pastor at St. Paul's Evangelical Congregational Church in nearby Rothsville, said he's heard long-term residents say the newcomers want the benefits of having that kind of community, but they want to change the ethos that actually created it. That includes religious expression in public schools. Yet that kind of expression is a big part of what has created the unity within a whole area within the town, said Miller. Ministeriums can often help when times are hard, said Dr. Joyce Mercer, Associate Dean for Academic Affairs and a Professor of Practical Theology at Yale Divinity School. "While many clergy are tired," said Mercer, "in some contexts, being in an ecumenical ministry can actually be a kind of respite from the struggle because you're not in it alone." In Mannheim, Pennsylvania, where the clergy belong to a separate, slightly smaller ministerium, the Reverend Kate Warren, pastor of Zion Evangelical Lutheran Church, said that her group had taken the isolation of the pandemic as an opportunity to read and discuss several books about racial issues. We had time. A lot of things were shut down. It gave us a chance to get to know each other in ways that might not have happened, to learn and to grow together. There's no denying that the social and political stresses of the COVID years and clergy exhaustion have taken their toll on engagement with the ministerium. That decline parallels the community's diminished religious feeling, some clergy say. St. Paul Lutheran Church in Lititz participated in the ministerium until recently by hosting a Good Friday service in the days before Easter, in which school children organized by TNT, a Lancaster area youth ministry, played a big part. But as the school district has become more diverse, said the Reverend Robert Mialis, St. Paul's senior pastor, it was harder to get kids to leave school to rehearse for what was clearly a religious service. And some of the ministerium's traditional activities, such as meeting with and praying for the police department and the school superintendent, are increasingly out of sync with the community Lancaster has become. I could see how all the new challenges and stressful situations for clergy throughout the pandemic would have increased the need for them to reach out to each other in ministerial networks and support groups, said Scott Thumma, director of the Hartford Institute, which studies church trends. At the same time, he wrote, nearly every religiously oriented gathering has suffered during the pandemic, with clergy reporting being stressed almost beyond capacity. Mialis echoes Thumma's concern about the future of ministeriums like Warwick's, but said, I think all of the churches are kind of figuring out who they are after COVID. In this small town, there is a tremendous desire by leaders to continue the deep sense of cooperation between government, church, education, and business. I think the leaders in this community will find a way, Mialis said, but it will depend on the willingness of all clergy to acknowledge the reality of change. We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payden, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.